Captain Cathode and the Secret Ace by Michael Cassatt. Interior Stratojet Bridge Day. The engines rumble as the Wolf Joker puts the Stratojet into a screaming turn. Cathode's hands are bound. We can hear pounding on the hatch. Marty, voiceover.
Captain, we're running out of air!
At the controls, the Wolf Joker turns and sneers. Wolf Joker.
Your choice, Captain. Surrender the codes, or all three of your friends breathe their last.
Cathode.
You'll die too, Joker.
Wolf Joker.
I'll aim the Stratojet at the mountain and bail out.
Cathode.
I knew it. Jokers are cowards at heart.
Wolf Joker.
Insults, Cathode. Pointless and ill-aimed.
The Wolf Joker rips off his face. It's a mask, of course. Under it, the smug, mustached face of Rowan Mercado, Cathode's Takesian nemesis. Cathode.
Mercado. I should have known.
Carl von Kampen closed the script and turned it face down on his desk. It was early on a Monday morning, August 1956. The temperature outside the Republic studio offices of Captain Cathode, close by the Santa Monica Mountains in the San Fernando Valley, was already approaching 90 and would easily top 100. A rattling air conditioner promised more cooling than it delivered. Yet here in his corner office, Carl felt a chill. A Cathode script need not rise to the level of Macbeth. It was not necessary to have the conceptual wonder of H.G. Wells. It didn't need to be as exciting as Hellcats of the Navy. But the old masked villain gag? What was Willie Lay thinking? Carl rose from his chair and stretched, not only to relieve the growing tension, but simply to change the geometry of his surroundings. His office was as spare and precise as, he hoped, the inner landscape of his mind. A simple desk and chair, a typewriter on which he wrote first draft memos, a credenza filled with 6 weeks of Captain Cathode scripts, no more, no less. Carl was a small man with whitish blonde hair and blue eyes, a perfect Aryan specimen, if not for the rounded shoulders. He had never been remotely athletic. Or, more notably, a limp, the legacy of a wound received in a bombing raid at Peenemunde during the war. He was relieved to hear the phone ring. His assistant, Abigail.
The set called, she said, and Carl knew the message before hearing the words. Brandt is late again.
Brandt Brewer, Captain Cathode himself. Plucking one of his many sets of dark glasses from the drawer, Carl was out of his office and looming over Abigail before she had replaced the receiver in its cradle.
Contact Sol Green and tell him Mr. von Kampen is unhappy.
Green was Brewer's agent. Carl knew the call would be a pointless exercise. He rarely saw agent without client, but Brewer might be motivated by a warning.
Mr. von Kampen will be even less happy to know that Harold Dan of Kellogg's will be on set at 9.
Dan was the chief buyer for Kellogg's, the breakfast cereal company that was trying to gain full sponsorship of Cathode, a move that would double the series' budget and would make Carl rich.
Stall him, Carl said. Angered to the point of violence, he picked the Morning Herald off Abigail's desk.
He immediately focused on the lead article about a body turned to stone near the Griffith Park Observatory.
Ach, the Medusa killer has struck again.
The series of awful deaths went back 3 months. All jokers turned to stone.
And the sun rose this morning, too.
Carl, you are evil.
The word is cynical.
It amused him to pretend that he knew English better than Abigail did. She actually had a degree from some Eastern college.
Evil, I said, and I'm sticking to it.
Abigail was 25, slim, dark-haired, easy to imagine as the only gal reporter in a newsroom filled with wisecracking men. Carl loved her voice as well as her refreshing disregard of the conventions of a business relationship, such as those forbidding a secretary to address her boss by his first name.
The only thing that makes this new set different from the usual Joker murders is that the victims aren't young women, but men.
Actors, I bet, Carl said bitterly. Killed by producers.
He gave Abigail a farewell smile, then placed dark glasses on his face.
As you said, evil.
Carl was being unfair to himself.
Though he had a rough German sense of humor, sharpened by brutal experiences in the war, he empathized with anyone who had a weakness, who was vulnerable. Anyone who hid a wild card. Carl even had a name for his own. Focus, complete with German spelling. Focus gave him the gift of enhanced vision, the ability to zoom in and often through any object in line of sight. It was not just a physical ability, it was in fact a state of mind, a moment when time stretched, one he was still struggling to control. As Carl crossed the hot asphalt, a simple glance toward the mountains at the north end of the valley triggered focus. Suddenly, distant Mount Wilson, with its observatory and collection of radio and television transmission towers, appeared close up. Another blink, and Carl saw the white dome of the huge 100-inch reflector, its paint peeling. Another blink, the tower belonging to KNX Radio, one of its red safety lights burned out. There was an almost sexual satisfaction in exercising focus. It had to be private, of course, an easy concession, since focus also required special circumstances, such as an inviting target, near or far. It was not a wild card power that made Carl stand out, except for one thing. His eyes blazed red instead of blue, hence the dark glasses, never out of reach, no matter how often he was teased for being pretentious. The glasses marked Carl von Kampen just as thoroughly as his German accent. At times he wondered which was the more prominent handicap in 1956 Hollywood, being an ace or having worked for Hitler. Entering the soundstage was like stepping into a dark, inviting cave. For a moment, Carl could forget the constant concern about money, the pressure from his boss, Frederick Ziv. He could remove his glasses. The first to notice Carl's presence on stage was Eugene Okulvitz, the rotund, frequently drunken gnat actor who played dog-faced Joker Turk, Captain Cathode's sidekick. "Here comes the Fuhrer! Wie geht's?" he added, slapping Carl on the back. "That's what I came to find out." Carl did not like Okulvitz. Compared to Brewer, Eugene was a consummate professional, always on time, never missing his mark or forgetting his lines, but he took his minor role far too seriously, and the costume girl said he often took his rubber dog mask home with him. He claimed he liked to stay in character when he rehearsed, but... "We've been working around Brandt for the first scene," Okulvitz said. "Shot our sides, right, baby?" Baby was addressed to Nora, actress Dottie Doyle, the statuesque, blue-eyed marvel whose magnificent legs were constantly on display in her cathode stratojet uniform. Carl reminded himself to compliment the costume designer, who obviously understood that a kiddie show could get away with hemlines that would have been judged scandalous on a series aimed at adults. "I'm not your baby, Jean." Dottie didn't even address him directly, planting herself directly in front of Carl. "And we can't get anything done like this." Typical Dottie, informed, cool, businesslike, the type of Nordic princess Carl's parents would have welcomed as a mate for their son. Carl walked around the flats to the front of the set. The lights had been turned off while the grips removed the control panel of Cathode's stratojet.
"She's right, Carl,"
said Marshall Korshak, the beleaguered director.
"The rest of the day is all Cathode."
Korshak was nervous even when things went smoothly. He had come to Cathode from Hopalong Cassidy. Carl forced a smile.
"It could be worse, Marshall. We could have horses."
"Horses are always there when you need them, or you get a new one and no one knows the difference."
At that moment, a production assistant hurried past them, uttering,
"He's here,"
then continuing on to avoid being collateral damage in the explosion to come. The same self-protective impulse caused Korshak to announce that he had to take a piss. Carl steeled himself for the encounter. But once his eyes adjusted to the sharp change of light, he realized it wasn't Brant Brewer, Captain Cathode. It was Harold Dan from Kellogg's. Dan was pushing 40, dark, heavy-set, and balding, and he had the whitest teeth Carl had seen on any human, not an actor. Dan, in fact, smiled with every sentence he uttered, as if he were getting paid per second of dazzle. Introductions were made to Okulvitz and Dottie. Dan's eyes widened at his first sight of Cathode's female companion.
"I'm thinking we should put you on the cereal box."
If legs and knockers sell cornflakes, why not?
Before the banter could escalate, Carl heard,
What's wrong with you people? Can't you see we have immortal television to make?
Brant Brewer, known to millions of American youth as Captain Cathode, scourge of the Takesians and their rogue Joker allies, strode from the shadows and planted himself in the center of the set, hands on his hips, a poster child for strength, justice, and American values. He was wearing his skin-tight navy blue flight suit, emblazoned with the letter C and a lightning bolt. Every time Carl saw his captain, no matter how angry he might be, he wished for the ability to broadcast in color. Either that or the ability to shoot explosive rays from his focused eyes.
Brant, you are 2 hours late.
The hair and makeup girl just won't let me out of the trailer.
Brewer's smile was as dazzling as Dan's, but completely natural. Carl didn't doubt that the hair and makeup girl had a crush on the star. Most women in the crew did, and no doubt some of the men.
You're hours late every other day, and it's killing us!
We're getting the scenes, Carl.
We're working around you to get the scenes, and they are never as good as they could be.
Brewer brandished a script.
How can this be good? I'm a man in a suit playing tricks on masked idiots. I can't shoot them. I can't throw them out the hatch. All I can do is speak sharply to them and tell them to eat their spinach.
In argument, Brewer reverted to his original Cajun accent, just as Carl grew more Teutonic. It was a wonder they understood each other at all.
Our audience is young children. They see enough violence in their real lives.
Children aren't served by horse shit. Are you actually reading the scripts, Carl?
Brant's expression changed from defiance to compassion.
Forget the dramatic simplifications. Are the children of America served by this portrayal of aces and jokers? Huh? Is putting Gene Okovitz in a dog mask better than casting a true...
Stop it!
Carl could see that Brewer was, as always, shifting the argument away from his own errors to Hollywood's cowardice about the wild card.
You know, we cannot use real jokers. How many times must we discuss that? The series is properly designed. You are part of it, or not. Keep being late to the set, and you will be dismissed.
Do you want to go down in history as the man who fired Captain Cathode?
Carl flicked the front of Cathode's costume with his fingers.
Captain Cathode is whoever wears the suit, hm?
Then Brewer's visage changed again, radiating warmth and eternal friendship.
You're the boss.
He looked around as if searching for allies and spotted Korshak.
Are we making television here or what?
Carl was still so shaken from the encounter that it took him a moment to realize someone behind him was clapping. Dan.
You are sitting on a gold mine here, Mr. Von Kampen.
The series does well.
And should continue to do well, but the big bucks won't come from the young eyeballs tuning in every afternoon. It'll come from what those young people force their parents to buy. The Captain Cathode comic books and toys, the pajamas, the helmets, the models of the Stratojet, the figurines.
And the breakfast cereal.
You'd better get control of your actor.
He was not smiling. Before he could take any steps, Carl had to suffer through a scoring session for next week's 5 episodes of Cathode. To call it a scoring session was a stretch, of course. Every music cue was stock, already recorded. The spotting was mechanical. Every villainous appearance or fake climax received the same melodramatic sting. To Carl, the repetitions were like insect bites, small but frequent and annoying. As he left the dub stage, he saw the man he needed.
Jack!
Jack Braun, the famed Judas Ace, more recently the star of Ziv's Tarzan of the Apes, looked impossibly tan and bizarrely young in khakis and white shirt. His wild card, of course.
Hello, Carl. How's your captain?
Braun's smirk told him he knew all about Brant's absences. Well, Braun still had friends all over the Republic lot.
It's just what I want to talk to you about, Jack.
Braun's eyes narrowed.
You'd be crazy to cast me, Carl. That ace is still a scarlet letter, to mix a few metaphors.
I know that. It would be too expensive and risky to recast right now. I want to know why Brant Brewer can't make it to the set on time.
I'm too busy with Tarzan to keep up with him.
You're wired into everything that happens here.
Because it's the only way to survive. Take it from a man who had to learn that the hard way.
So teach me.
You're doing all right on your own.
Carl merely crossed his arms. He had enough experience with actors to recognize a performance. Today's was Jack Braun, reluctant Hollywood operator. It didn't last. Braun took out one of his cards.
Okay.
The guy you want is named Edison Hill. You can find him here every afternoon after 2.
Carl read the name on the back of the card.
The Menagerie, Santa Monica Pier. Is this Hill a drunkard or a fug?
The pier was a notorious homosexual stroll and a favorite haunt for the city's small joker population.
Neither one, so far as I know. He won't punch you in the nose if you buy him a cocktail, but mostly he's just a guy who knows things, or knows how to find them out. The Menagerie is basically his office.
Carl never met Braun without wanting to tell him he was a fellow ace, and without instantly realizing the futility of such a gesture.
You know, Jack, one of these days, all this insanity will be over. We should work together.
Braun smiled with genuine warmth and knowing skepticism.
It would be great to think so, wouldn't it?
He almost missed the Menagerie. It was partway down, snuggled up next to the Santa Monica Pier's infamous merry-go-round, and surrounded by carny games, food stalls, and freak shows, almost all of them Joker-owned and operated. Inside the club was dim and cramped, smelling of stale beer and old sawdust. A female Joker was grinding away on the club's tiny stage, twirling the tassels on her sequined brassiere and bumping her posterior to the music.
I've been coming here for years, Hill said. I have a weakness for beauty unadorned.
He was slim, tallish, good-looking in a B-movie second banana way, complete with the Dick Powell mustache. He sounded as though he'd grown up far to the east of Los Angeles.
There are some amazing people here, Carl said.
They can be an acquired taste, Hill said.
It was mid-afternoon, hardly prime time for any club, and the Menagerie was largely empty. Nevertheless, the dancer on stage was a true beauty by any standards, though when she dropped her bra, Carl saw that she had mouths where her nipples should have been. He didn't want to think about what might be under her G-string.
What do you do when you're not doing this?
He asked Hill, out of due diligence more than polite curiosity.
You could call me a spook, Hill said, then added, ghostwriter. As told to projects, speeches, this and that. A few detective stories for the pulps.
A good living?
Some of the pulp stories pay well enough, but I was in the Navy, pre-war. Caught a spot on my lung and was sent ashore.
You didn't go back on active duty during the war?
Tried and tried. It wouldn't take me.
Hill set down his drink and laced his fingers together.
Now, how may I help you?
Carl quickly recounted his problems with Brant Brewer.
You think he's a Red?
Doubtful.
Carl knew real Hollywood communists. Brant Brewer was nothing like them.
Homo?
Carl opened his hands.
Well, he is an actor.
Meaning that homosexuality was always a possibility.
Okay, we'll put a pin in that one.
Hill casually glanced to the right and left. When he spoke, Carl could barely hear him. That leaves the wild card factor.
There are no signs, but...
My fee is $20 a day plus expenses, 40 up front. Normally it would be half that, but when the case involves wild cards...
He gestured to the denizens of the Menagerie.
Fine,
Carl carefully counted out 4 tens.
You'll get a full report, where Brewer lives, how he spends his days, what he does, and with whom. You'll enjoy the style, if not the content.
They agreed to meet at a coffee shop on Franklin and Western the next morning at 8. If Hill needed to reach Carl immediately, he would call the office and identify himself as Mr. Edwards. If Carl needed Hill, he was to call Hill's answering service. Hill reached for his hat and slid off the stool, then adjusted cuffs, collar, fedora brim. He actually gave Carl a 2-finger salute as he departed. The production wrapped at 7 p.m., an hour over schedule. Double overtime for the crew, thanks to Brewer's lateness. But with Mr. Dan of Kellogg's liable to turn up around any corner, Carl chose to avoid further confrontation and had Abigail phone for his taxi. He lived in a duplex in the hills above Hollywood. His landlady was a silent film actress named Estelle Blair, forcibly retired by the introduction of sound, permanently shelved thanks to the wild card, which had made her an invisible woman, a girly-voiced wraith detectable only as a disembodied overcoat and slippers. Carl had seen a picture of the silent era Estelle. She had been blonde, leggy, a pouty-lipped flapper goddess. He wondered what she looked like now, in her 50s. Did she even know? She was notoriously difficult to deal with, except when it came to Carl. She, or rather her dressing gown, was there to greet him as he was dropped off.
"You work too hard," she said. "Have you had dinner?"
"Yes, at the studio."
He made sure to tell Estelle this, even if he hadn't. He didn't want to be forced to accept a dinner invitation, and to answer the lingering question of just where a bite of food went from being visible to invisible as Estelle swallowed it. He accepted his mail, plucking it out of what appeared to be thin air, and went inside. The furnishings here were as Spartan as in Carl's office at the studio. A couch, a low table, several chairs. The bedroom beyond was similarly underdone, and so was the kitchen. Other than his twice-daily use of taxis, Carl's one concession to his status as producer was the biggest television on the market, a 17-inch Zenith X2552, complete with console. He made sure to watch the final cuts of Cathode on a screen the same size or even smaller, that being the way the audience would see the show. Carl normally turned the Zenith on the moment he entered his place. Not only was the box where he made his living, it had now become company most nights. But before Carl could switch on the set, he saw in his mail a letter from Herb Cranston, the former director of operations at White Sands, the first human to come face to face with Dr. Tachyon, was in town tonight, suggesting dinner at Musso's at 8. Carl glanced at his watch. 8:30, but Musso's was just down the road. He called for a taxi.
"Ach, if it isn't Herr Campen."
Carl had entered Musso's through the back entrance and had been scanning the dining room for Herb Cranston, a tricky process given the booths. The rocket man was sitting at the counter, the remains of what appeared to have been a hearty meatloaf dinner in front of him, and a cocktail or three.
"I only just got your message."
"Have you eaten?"
"Yes."
"Well then, much as I enjoy the atmosphere here, I've heard so much about the Jokers of Santa Monica. They should build a sign. Jokerland."
It took Carl several seconds to realize that Cranston was interested in actually visiting the pier and sampling the seedy underside of Joker life. Normally, Carl would have recoiled, as much from ignorance as from disgust. He had been to the pier a few times, and a few times was enough. Joker prostitutes riding the merry-go-round, calling out to passing men. Horrific faces behind stalls, selling cheap souvenirs and fried foods. Knife fights between Joker gang members, deformity, desperation, and drugs mingled with the smells of salt water, grease, and rotting fish. But tonight, two factors had changed. He really wanted to see Cranston, and he knew a Joker club. It was odd to be visiting a place like the Menagerie twice in a lifetime, let alone a single day. Santa Monica Pier seemed more glamorous at night, with its colored lights gleaming and music pouring from the merry-go-round. Crowds of gnats mingled with the Jokers, eating ice cream sandwiches and hot dogs as they wandered amongst the games and dives and freak shows. Inside the menagerie, the Joker dancers were somehow more attractive, or possibly just more varied and numerous.
"This gives new meaning to the term exotic dancer," Cranston said.
He loved to pun. In their time at White Sands, Carl's English had been too rudimentary to recognize most of them. He no longer had that excuse. There was a good-sized crowd, too, for a midweek night, or so Carl assumed. The pier and its nightlife were not among his areas of expertise. As a trio of dancers worked the stage, they called themselves the American Girls, and they were, successively, red, white, and blue beneath their flag-themed costumes. A spectacular femcat, complete with spotted fur and swirling tail, joined Carl and Cranston at their table.
Interested in some company?
Cranston waved the girl away and began talking shop. Things are finally starting to happen up at Tomlin.
Still trying to make sense of Tachyon secrets. Reverse engineering a Tachyon ship.
Hell no. Wright Field's got nothing better to do. Let them waste their time. Encouraged by the alcohol and needing to be heard over the roar, Cranston practically shouted. Then, embarrassed, he said in a quieter voice,
Carl, we are back in the business of doing our own designs and cutting metal. Watch the skies. Pretty soon you're going to see something flying that was made on Earth.
He took another drink, then smiled. Just like your little strato jet.
Congratulations.
Some of our White Sands friends are with us, even Willie Ley. Ley had gotten out of Germany before the war, becoming a writer of popular journalism about rocketry, which is why Carl had sought him out for cathode.
The guy we really need is you. You are the most promising one of the bunch.
My friend, you are as inaccurate as you are drunk. That bunch included von Braun, Rudolf, Dornberger, so many others.
I didn't mean in accomplishments. We know you got to Peenemunde Munda straight out of school. And hell, none of us got out of the starting blocks at White Sands, not after Baby showed up.
Cranston and von Braun and a handful of former Nazi engineers had been ordered to meet Tachyon and his shell-like Tachyon ship when it landed at White Sands. Carl and the rest, however, were kept away, occupied with calisthenics, endless reports, and English lessons.
Did Willie put you up to this?
Cranston shrugged.
He simply said we ought to ask. He should not have done that without telling me.
Then I wouldn't have been able to surprise you. Cranston smirked. He was drunk enough that he was beginning to get sentimental. Carl remembered him as a heavy drinker.
Both of us. So lucky. The wild card never got us.
Yes.
The wild card had gotten Carl von Kampen, of course. In 1947, he had followed Walter Dornberger to Bell Aircraft in Buffalo, and was mired in the tedium of creating designs for a bomber that would likely never be built, when he came down with what he thought, hoped, was the flu. After days of fever and delirium, he recovered to find that his vision had been altered. Previously myopic to the point of blindness, he could now see down to a near microscopic level, or up to the level of the best optical telescopes. He had focus. There was a side effect. For several minutes after focus, Carl's eyes blazed a demonic red. At first he thought it was a temporary effect, but within a couple of weeks, as he struggled to master his new talent, he realized it was likely permanent, a sign of his status as an ace. That was when he began wearing dark glasses. Hating the work at Bell, hating Buffalo even more, Carl decided to fulfill a lifelong dream. He wrote to the famed film director Fritz Lang, the man who had made the world's first rocket movie, The Lady in the Moon. Lang was a friend of Dornberger's and had a soft spot for discarded German rocketeers like Carl von Kampen. The filmmaker offered to give Carl a recommendation should he ever find himself in Los Angeles. Packing all his possessions, Carl had moved to Hollywood the next week. There, his focus established him as a valuable asset to any camera crew. He had risen from assistant to operator to cinematographer to line producer to cathode. Before Carl could gauge the effect of his lie on Cranston, the Femcat had returned.
Feeling friendlier now that we've had our icebreaker?
She asked, sliding back into his lap. Cranston seemed more receptive.
You are a persistent one, aren't you?
I'm not sure what that means. It's an awfully big word.
She nibbled on Cranston's ear, to the engineer's all-too-obvious enjoyment.
And I like big things.
Carl found that he enjoyed Femcat's antics, too. She noted his interest.
You're too cute to be alone, handsome. See anyone here you'd like to meet?
Not at present, sir. Thank you.
The Joker girl purred with laughter.
Ah, a shy one. What do you two do, anyway?
He's a rocket scientist,
Carl said, trying to direct the Femcat's attention back to Cranston. Not to be outdone, Cranston said, Carl here is the producer of Captain Cathode. Carl could have killed him. It was one thing to be trolling through a Joker club. It was quite another matter to be recognized in one.
Femcat seemed pleased, however.
Then you know Brant and Jean.
Quite well, Carl said, trying to hide his surprise. Do you?
Of course. Jean said he would try to get me on the show. Turk needs a girl, don't you think? Cats and dogs, the kids would love it. And think of all you'd save on makeup.
She gave a throaty laugh.
I'm only doing this to pay the rent, you know. I'm really an actress.
Of course she was. He knew what kind of actress, too. There was a growing market for Joker smut films, he had heard.
I didn't know they were regulars here, said Carl. How often do they come here?
He focused on her pretty feline face, noted the glistening drops of moisture in her whiskers, a raised brow, the mouth slightly open. In a gnat, they would have been clear signs of hesitation, or fear. The Femcat had said too much, and all at once she had seemed to realize it.
I wouldn't call them regulars. They're just guys I've met. Excuse me.
She slithered off Cranston. The Rocket Man didn't seem all that sorry to see her go.
It's going to be a long drive back to Mojave.
In this condition, you'll be lucky to reach Lancashire.
Carl helped Cranston down to the end of the pier, where a line of cabs was waiting. He had his former colleague dropped at the Roosevelt Hotel, then told the cabbie to head down Hollywood Boulevard to Gower. From there, he walked. It was less than a mile, straight up Gower to Scenic, then a few blocks east to Beechwood. He needed time to let the booze wear off, time to think. He could continue as he was, grinding out episodes of a children's television series until it died, then another, until he died, or worse than death, fell out of fashion. He could sell his share of cathode to Kellogg's and use the money to support himself for life. No more silly stories of treacherous aces outwitted by an idiot in a blue suit. Or he could take up Cranston's offer and return to his life's work. But he could do none of it until he resolved the Brant Brewer problem. His star was hanging out at a Joker dive, which might explain the increasing number of late mornings. But what was Gene Olkowitz doing with him? As far as Carl knew, the two were nothing more than set colleagues, and Olkowitz sure wasn't showing up late. At the corner of Gower and Franklin, he stopped to use a payphone. He left an urgent message for Edison Hill. At 8:30 the next morning, Carl was still sitting in the coffee shop at Franklin and Western, emboldened by last night's stroll and counting on the sunshine and exercise to mitigate his hangover. Carl had walked, eager to hear what Edison Hill had learned. But Edison Hill had not shown up. All he could do was wait and read the Herald's follow-up stories about the Medusa killer. There had been 7 such murders over the past 20 months, all victims male, all jokers between the ages of 25 and 50. None of them the obvious victim. No derelicts, hopheads, rent boys. They were as solid citizens as any joker could ever hope to be. Veterans, attorneys, accountants, file clerks, mechanics, a man who ran a gas station in Glendale, even an ex-fireman and a couple of former teachers who had lost their jobs when their cards turned. No parents wanted jokers near their children. None of this was immediately relevant to Carl. He wanted to know about handsome, charming, mysterious Brant Brewer, the man who held the keys to Carl's future. At 9, he gave up the wait, dropping a dollar on the counter and calling for a cab. He had already given $40 to a man he had met in a Joker bar. He would have to have words with Jack Braun the next time he saw him. Carl von Kampen hated feeling foolish. He was dropped as usual at the front gate. To his surprise, Abigail met him in the parking lot. He regarded her through his glasses.
Why aren't you in the office?
Because Saul Green is waiting for you.
Let me guess.
Brant is late again.
Carl's head began to hurt, and this time it could not be blamed on the previous night's alcohol intake.
Tell me better news.
They found another dead guy in Silver Lake last night. Turned to stone, Carl.
If Saul Green gives me any grief, he'll be found petrified in Silver Lake. Have him meet me at the set.
Carl did not want to face the giant agent in his office, and he needed to reassure the skittish Korshak that he would not be blamed for the delays. Sure enough, Brant Brewer's parking spot was still empty, but next to it was a shiny black 2-door Hudson Hollywood,
the type of car Carl would buy, if he bought one. It belonged to Saul Green, who somehow managed to reach the soundstage at the same time as Carl.
"Going to be a hot one again today,"
Green said. In the best of times, Carl had little patience for Green and his brand of chat.
"Why are you here instead of your clients?"
"Brandt is having personal problems. Medical problems."
"So he's in the hospital?"
"Not yet. His life is not at risk."
"Only his career."
Green took Carl's elbow and somehow moved him several feet away.
"Carl, you and I have never been good friends."
"In fact, we're barely past the mortal enemy stage."
"Yet this is a business that runs on friendships, some of them quite unlikely."
"Do you want to be my friend, Saul? Is that what this is all about?"
"Not me, but, how well do you understand actors, Carl?"
"I pay them a lot of money to show up and say their lines. What else do I need to know?"
The big man shook his head as if correcting a child's errors.
"The best of them are empty inside, easy prey for whatever passion or fashion that comes along. It's what makes them good at what they do, becoming other people."
"So, Brandt Brewer has somehow imprinted on someone who is chronically tardy, hm?"
"No, I'm saying he needs understanding, flexibility."
"We're already rearranging every other shooting day, Saul. Have you tried this theory on Harold Dan? Hm? Somehow I don't think our new sponsor is going to be understanding about shows that are late or don't exist."
"You don't need to bring Kellogg's into this. They're only interested in money."
"You are what, huh? An altruist?"
"I'm Brandt Brewer's friend, and I'm asking you, as someone who could be your friend, to back off."
Green leaned close to Carl. There was no friendliness in his manner.
"Stop having him followed."
"We're done, Saul."
Carl reached for the soundstage door. Only the red light warning the cameras were rolling kept him from opening it.
"How would you like it, Carl? Wouldn't you agree this is still a bad time to have your, private life made public? What would that do to your career?"
Carl stared at the agent.
"Don't threaten me."
Now Green smiled and spread his hands.
"I'm just offering some friendly advice."
He started to turn, then, over his shoulder, said,
"Nice touch with the glasses, by the way."
Carl fled into the dark sanctuary of his set, his hands trembling and his stomach sour. Saul Green knew his secret. By the time Brewer showed up just before lunch, Carl had retreated to his office with orders not to be disturbed. There was smoke in the air, apparently from some fire up in the hills, distant sirens. Carl found it all unnerving. Yet he was feeling more kindly toward Edison Hill by now. At least he had retreated from judging him to be a con man. Jack Braun would not have recommended anyone like that. On impulse, he ordered Abigail to find a home address and telephone for Hill. He didn't like waiting. Then he tried to lose himself in the next cathode scripts, but his worries about Brewer and Green and Kellogg's, combined with the sheer banality of the latest storyline, plus the numbing rattle of the air conditioner, left him frustrated and unhappy. He reflected on his association with Brandt Brewer. He had simply seen the actor as a face in an 8x11 glossy, along with a short list of credits that ranged from secondary roles on Broadway to live television, and a few guest roles on other Ziv television series. Black-haired, blue-eyed, Brewer just looked like a hero. And in the round of auditions, he had shown he could sound like one, too. A deal had been made through Saul Green before Carl and Brewer ever had a conversation, and the rigors of producing over 115-minute low-budget episodes in each of two television seasons had made it impossible to progress beyond that. They had never been friends, never shared a meal or a drink. Their only social encounters had been at occasional holiday parties. He knew even less about the rest of his cast. Olkowitz was another Green client who had, Carl recalled, been auditioned in character, already wearing the dog mask. Carl wouldn't have minded getting to know Dottie Doyle a lot better, but his ace complicated his romantic life. Focus diverted normal sexual urges into his own peculiar form of voyeurism. Besides, Carl recoiled from the role of producer preying on actress. Realizing that it was now close to 5 p.m. and that he hadn't eaten, he wandered into the outer office, finding it empty except for a note with Edison Hill's home address and phone and the words, "Tried this, number not in service." Carl was irritated by Abigail's absence until he remembered two things. He had given her permission to leave for a medical appointment, and it was the Edison Hill situation that was unnerving him. In the best German tradition, he decided to take action. Hill's address was 8777 Lookout Mountain. An amusing coincidence. Fritz Lang had lived on Lookout Mountain when Carl had visited a decade back. The location was less than 5 miles from the studios of Captain Cathode. But it took over an hour to reach it. The route south on Laurel Canyon was blocked by fire trucks at Mulholland Drive. Carl's cabbie suggested an alternate route, which took them around 3 sides of a square, down Woodrow Wilson, then through a side canyon, then back up Laurel from the north. More fire trucks clogged the intersection of Laurel Canyon and Lookout Mountain, but it was still possible to drive past them, straight up the narrow road. However, after several turns, Carl's cab ran into the ultimate roadblock, a trio of Los Angeles police units. "This is as far as you go," an officer told Carl.
"I'm a resident."
He hated lying, but he still needed to reach Hill's house. "My friend, if you live up here, you should call your insurance agent. We've had 4 homes burned, and we don't have the fire completely contained." Carl removed his sunglasses and peered further up the road. Several of the strange little canyon dwellings, vertical structures that reminded Carl of treehouses, were damaged or gone. Trees on the hills were smoking stumps. Even the street sign was soot-smeared.
"What's the fire trucks are down at Laurel?"
The officer stared at Carl. "You should turn around, sir. The smoke is bad for your eyes." Carl had tried to press the matter, but then his driver grew impatient. After a laborious Y-turn under the scrutiny of several cops, the cab headed back down the road.
"Here,"
Carl said, once they had turned out of sight. He paid the driver, then began walking back toward what used to be Edison Hill's house. One of the web-like side roads allowed Carl to skirt the police barrier and climb parallel to Lookout Mountain. He found himself emerging from unburnt foliage to look down on the scene. On the blackened slope above what used to be 8777 Lookout Mountain lay a strange object, a block of stone that, through Carl's focus, appeared to be a statue of a human male cowering in fear, a man with a pencil mustache. It was a long, choking walk down Laurel Canyon past Hollywood Boulevard, which had nothing but houses this far west, to sunset. There he headed for Schwab's, phoning for a taxi. Once it had arrived and was taking him east toward home, he considered telling the driver to turn north toward Tomlin Air Force Base. Carl von Kampen had had enough of Hollywood. As he walked up the steps to his duplex, he smelled the rich fragrance of jasmine, a considerable improvement over the smoke and ash of Laurel Canyon. The cool air revived him. He paused and looked back. As he did, he focused again, unbidden, and was rewarded with a cascade of images near and far. A robin on a telephone wire, a ball kicked by a neighbor child in a tiny backyard, stopped in mid-flight. A puff of smoke from an exhaled cigarette further down Beechwood. A cloud of moths around a streetlight. On the hillside, a hunched coyote. All of it linked by ribbons of cracked concrete, foliage, pipes, the blur of autos in motion. Even if Saul Green or Brant Brewer turned out to be the Medusa killer, Carl had faced greater challenges. He had built rockets. He had survived a British bombing raid. He had lived through the wild card. He had turned himself into a Hollywood producer. Surely he could find a way to control Brant Brewer. Halfway to his front door, he was grabbed, a hand above his elbow, an invisible hand.
"Go back," Estelle Blair said.
It was a challenge to turn casually while trying to spot a potential assailant. Carl wasn't sure of success until he had descended to the sidewalk without feeling a knife blade or bullet in his back.
"Estelle," he said.
"Right behind you."
"What's going on?"
"2 men, nasty looking, overdressed for the heat. They started sneaking around about an hour ago. I heard them and made myself scarce, if you know what I mean.
Carl was still making his way back to Beechwood, toward the corner grocery and witnesses.
I get the idea.
I think they were going to follow you inside. One of them had a gun.
A car started up. Moments later, a Hudson Hollywood rolled down Carl Street and quickly turned south onto Beechwood. There were two men inside in hats and overcoats, one of them easily big enough to be Saul Green.
Are you in some kind of trouble, Carl?
Apparently.
He had felt nausea and apprehension at the charred ruins of Edison Hill's house. Now he felt pure fear. Whoever killed Hill had somehow connected them.
Maybe you can't see clearly with your sunglasses.
That may be.
It was possible that Estelle knew his secret, too. She could have been spying on him for the past 3 years. Silly of him to have chosen a landlady who was the one person immune to focus.
Well, my father back in Iowa, bless his soul, had a method for dealing with bothersome people. Do unto them before they do unto you.
Estelle, Carl said. I couldn't agree more.
Brant Brewer lived on Drexel Avenue, not far from the farmer's market in Gilmore Field, north of the Wilshire Miracle Mile. The cab stopped at Gilmore Field, where the Hollywood Stars were playing a minor league baseball game. Carl could walk the 4 blocks to Brewer's address. It would give him time to further consider his dwindling options. The sun was setting, offering the promise of relief from the oppressive heat, though the haze in the air would linger for days. Carl was grateful for the lack of a moon. That awful night at Peenemunde had seen a full moon, the better to aid British bombers. Although 2 stories tall, Brewer's house was modest in size, situated on impressive grounds behind a fence, largely hidden from the street. Carl slipped close to the fence, focusing through the bars and the bushes beyond. He could see Green's Hollywood parked in the hemispherical driveway, along with other vehicles. He focused on the peeling paint on the walls of the house, a cricket making a major effort to get across a pavement crack. No obvious obstacles, but no obvious weapons. Carl had his plan, and it was worthy of Captain Cathode. He hoped he lived long enough to share the scheme with Willie Lay. A last glance at the quiet neighborhood around him, then he opened the gate and walked up to the front door. As he became aware of the laughter and music from inside, Carl stepped back. He could still abort the whole mission. Depending on whether the next half hour went according to script, these people would be in danger. There was also the temptation to simply let it go. Sign the deal with Kellogg's and wash his hands of him. Let the cereal makers worry about Brewer's ability to hit his mark. No. Brewer had not just brought chaos to Carl's life. He and Saul Green had almost certainly killed Edison Hill, and who knew how many others. They were monsters, real-life versions of the cartoon Joker villains of Captain Cathode. They needed to be brought down. Carl knocked on the door. A moment later, a very surprised Gene Okovitz opened it. Or rather, Turk did. Okovitz was wearing the dog face mask. Carl had half expected it, but was still shocked to realize that the good captain's sidekick was not just playing the part on camera.
Is this where I say Guten Abend?
Carl said.
Or should I bark? What are you doing here? Why are you wearing that mask?
Joker pussy, said Okovitz, smiling a rubbery grin. Joker girls are wild, Führer, and so grateful.
The actor turned as if to summon help. An angry-looking Saul Green was pushing through the crowd.
Are you insane?
Green said.
You wanted to see me, Saul. You even came to my house.
Carl smiled to show that he, like everyone in Hollywood since the pre-silent days, knew the old joke. Green could only shout,
Brant!
Brewer was slipping through a cluster of guests, all of them jokers, and what a collection. A lizard girl, a squamous thing with feet, a man who looked perfectly nat except for a pair of antennae rising from his head. He spied the femcat from the menagerie as well, squirming in the lap of a fat man with a face that looked as if it had been carved from oak. There were 6 more. The party was the opposite of Noah's Ark. No joker ever had a perfect mate. Carl felt as if he were back at the menagerie, The only things missing were the smell of French fries and the tinny music from the merry-go-round next door. Instead, there were embroidered rugs, fussy brocade couches, arty pictures on the walls, a Victrola.
"I don't see a television," Carl said as Brewer reached him. "Where do you watch yourself?"
"Would you believe I've never seen an episode?" Among the many shocking things Carl had heard lately, this was the capper. What kind of actor passed up a chance to watch himself?
"Well, why watch black and white television when you've got a colorful crowd like this every night?" Brewer was saying.
That was when Carl noticed the deliciously real Nora, Dolly in a pink sheath dress, her hair swirled into a golden nest, lips the color of blood, her eyes as blue as a tropic sea. He had never seen her looking so desirable, not even in his most shameful fantasies. She nodded to Carl, then inclined her head toward the corner of the living room, where Harold Dan smiled back at them, tipping a drink in Carl's direction. Carl had not seen the Kellogg's man for several days. Two of the dancers from the menagerie were with him, the American girls, Blue on his left, the red girl on his right. Carl turned to Brewer and Green.
"I get the idea you're celebrating something."
Had he mistaken a typical Hollywood backroom deal? Agent and actor going behind his back to steal cathode from him. For murder? Before Brewer could answer, Green and Okovitz had caught Carl, each man taking an elbow.
"Why don't we talk somewhere else?"
As he was hustled through the crowd, Carl caught Dottie's eye. He said,
"Get out of here,"
he told her.
"Get all of them out of here. Tell them the police are coming. A raid."
"Oh," she said. They wound up in the den, door closed, the three of them, Okovitz outside standing guard.
"You're either insane or the bravest man in the world," Green said.
"Would that be both?"
Brewer turned to his agent.
"Saul."
"Shut up, Brent!"
Green faced Carl.
"You actually are rather stupid, Carl, for a rocket scientist, that is."
"I didn't realize being stupid meant a death sentence in Hollywood. Why, the streets would be empty!"
Green backhanded him, a vicious move that surprised Carl as much as it hurt.
"You think this is our choice? You're a lucky one. Your race helps you."
"That's enough, Saul."
Brandt seemed genuinely upset. He put his hands on Green and gently moved the burly agent aside.
"What are you two?"
Carl asked, tasting blood and feeling a loose tooth with his tongue.
"Some kind of team?"
Brewer was not a good enough actor to hide his reaction.
"We need each other. Saul petrifies them. As he does, I feed."
He turned to his sullen, massive partner.
"It's a good thing we found each other."
"Brent?"
Green's face was wet with sweat.
"He deserves to know, Saul!"
Brewer seemed relieved at having a chance to confess.
"He's made us a lot of money." "But a kiddie TV star and a first-rate agent."
Carl couldn't resist turning to Green.
"Do you only get 10% of whatever you suck out of your victims?"
Green raised an arm for a second backhand, but Brewer stopped him.
"Stop it, Saul."
He got between the agent and Carl.
"You hear about junkies and the monkey on their backs? I'd trade this habit for heroin in a second."
He ran a finger across his forehead, wiping sweat.
"And it gets worse in this heat."
"But what do you get? Blood? Bones?"
Now Green laughed harshly.
"Well, go ahead. Tell him."
Amazingly, Brandt seemed ashamed, unable to frame the words.
"Saul transforms their bodies, and I take their souls. Their personalities. I can't actually be a hero. I can't play a real human until I do."
If he hadn't been half paralyzed with fear, Carl would have laughed. So, Brandt Brewer was the ultimate ace actor, a true empty vessel. For a moment, Carl felt pity for the man, even for Green. Everyone in the world claimed to know the physical price of the wild card, but what about mental changes? What twists and tortures had been inflicted on human brains by the Takesian virus? Then Saul Green grabbed Carl from behind, a bear hug that Carl knew he would never break.
Your buddy Hill turned out to be a hero, and you decided to be one too.
Carl could feel himself growing heavy, thicker, turning to stone.
Like I said, Carl, stupid.
Carl jammed a hand into his pocket.
Smells that?
Carl said, forcing out the words.
That's gas, and it has filled the house. All it takes to blow this to the moon is a light.
He managed to pull a lighter from his pocket. Brandt looked worried.
Saul, watch him.
But Saul Green smiled and shouted,
Gene?
The door opened and Okolvitz entered, a squirming figure in a sheet under one arm. He dropped the bundle on the floor, then sat on it. Green never lost his hold.
We may not be able to see your invisible friend, Carl, but Green has a great nose for a gnat. He sniffed her out.
The bundle on the floor squirmed as Brandt Brewer gently removed the lighter from Carl's stiffening hand.
It's all right, Estelle,
Carl said. She'd been caught. It was over. Brandt seemed astonished.
That was your plan? Walk in here and blow us up?
My plan,
Carl said, writhing in Green's grasp,
was to walk in here and try to talk sense into you. You can kill me the way you killed all the others, but if I die, it won't be just another Joker murder. I'm chairman. I'm your producer. I'm an ace. Who replaces me? Someone meaner and stronger. And when that happens, how long do you think you two will survive, Wouldn't it just be better to have some kind of peace?
He felt as though he was talking to himself. He was rooted now, feeling heavy, his skin hardening. He tried to focus, and he failed. Now all he could do was close his eyes and die. The door suddenly opened. There was a commotion, a shout from Green.
Brandt!
Carl opened his eyes and saw that he and Estelle had been left alone. The blanket had already been thrown aside.
Can you move?
Yes,
Carl said, though it wasn't easy. He felt like a man who had been sitting in one position for hours, as if his feet and legs and even hips had fallen asleep.
I think we should get out of here.
Painfully, reaching for Estelle's invisible and not especially substantial support, he stomped down the hallway into the living room. Dolly and Dan and the Joker partiers had gotten the message. The only people present were Brandt Brewer, Saul Green, and Eugene Okolvitz. Brewer was on the stairs, holding the lighter aloft as Green tried to reach him. He actually struck a pose that could have been seen nightly on Captain Cathode.
Put it down, Brandt!
Okolvitz was between them, still in his dog mask.
Back off, Saul!
Carl just hurried toward the front door, stumbling into the hot August night, desperate to put as much distance as he could between himself and Estelle and the house. As he reached the gate, he heard what sounded like the snap of a piece of rotted wood. The house erupted in a flash of light. A giant's hand slapped Carl, flattening him against a parked car. Deafened by the blast, his hands and knees skinned and raw from impact, Carl huddled against the side of a car as the fireball blossomed overhead. He pulled himself up, forcing himself to look, even though the air itself seemed ablaze.
Estelle,
he called.
Here, darling,
the voice came from behind him.
I don't feel so...
Carl heard a rustling thump as something hit the lawn. He bent to the challenge of trying to cradle an invisible woman. Behind him, Brandt Brewer's house was entirely engulfed, so violently shaken that the second floor had already collapsed into the first. No fire squad would be able to do anything. By the time they arrived, there would be nothing but ashes. 2 weeks later, on his way to Tomlin Air Force Base, the bus carrying Carl von Kampen stopped on the north side of Palmdale to gas up. Stretching his legs, still stiff from Saul Green's Medusa touch, Carl saw the headline of the newspaper the attendant was reading. Ziv TV introduces new Cathode. George Reeves starred in The Gone with the Wind and From Here to Eternity. The Kellogg's offer had died with Brandt Brewer. Fine. Harold Dan had left L.A. on the first plane back to Michigan. no doubt eager to escape before anyone asked inconvenient questions about what he had been doing at that party. Carl did not care. He wanted out of Hollywood. He had even given away his new Zenith to Estelle. He owed her much more, not just for saving his life, but for helping him understand why Brant Brewer had killed himself.
"Being a Joker was bad enough,"
she had told him.
"The suicide rates are appalling, you know. But actors are the most insecure people imaginable. They never know why they are popular or successful, only that they are, for a while. Brant Brewer must have realized that Captain Cathode was the best he could ever be, and that when you discovered the truth about him, it was all over."
Carl von Kampen replaced his dark glasses and peered into the future.